dear friends, when I put this title on the, and this blurb for the service on the website a couple of weeks ago, I was uncertain myself, as we all were, did not know where we would be this morning. I certainly hoped with all my heart that I would not be beginning, as I am, by saying that there is a very real threat of fascism in our country. As you know, if you heard my sermon about this a couple months ago, that is not a word I take lightly or throw around like just a mean name to call somebody when they're being a jerk or domineering. I mean fascism, a fascist government. And in just the few days, we've had examples aplenty. Nick Fuentes, avowed neo-Nazi, who enjoyed a private dinner with the former and incoming president in the White House a few years ago, has already been making predictably misogynist responses to the election. God, I hate to utter these words from this sacred place, but if you haven't heard them, you need to know. Your body, my choice. Racist texts have gone out to African Americans all over the country, as some of us learned when we got alerts from some, in some cases, our school districts, saying we support students and families involved in our congregation, in our congregations, in our schools and our communities who have received these anonymous racist texts all over the country. And of course, for years now, we have been seeing the scapegoating of people like immigrants and trans folks. All of these are clear markers of fascism. Racism, misogyny, rigid social hierarchies, and scapegoating of the vulnerable. Listen to Trump's speeches about migrants and just fill in the word Jews whenever you hear migrants, and you have the same dynamic as we saw in the 1930s. A French saying claims that every country gets the government it deserves. But I don't think anyone deserves fascism. People who have long been devoted to the Republican Party deserve a party that represents their views. People who have never voted Republican in their lives deserve a debate partner, a conversation partner, a opponent and wrestler in the legislatures, who is equally devoted to observing elections and accepting their outcome. And the world does not deserve to have to deal with a fascist United States, or even a US that's tolerant of totalitarian governments elsewhere. Somebody, I won't use his name because I forgot to ask permission, but someone in our sacred text group on Wednesday asked the question, has any dominant power of the world, you know, the dominant power, as we have been considered to be the single superpower for decades now, has it ever happened to the world that that country was fascist? Rome, somebody said, maybe, but as we know, Rome was only dominant over one small portion of the world. Anyone hates to imagine it, but here we are. And as tired as we may be, as sad, as reluctant to take on the fight, as citizens of the United States, we are the best people to do it. We're here, we know this country, we thought we did. We have a vote and a voice. So we will be fighting fascism and learning how here at UUCPA. But it's okay if you're not in that place today. We had our vigil on Wednesday night, and people brought so many different feelings, numbness and grief and surprise and fatalism and stoicism, determination. Some came in with an energy. What are we going to do? Let's do it. Some just wanted to grieve and be with other people who were grieving. These and all reactions are valid, and there is room for all of them here. Something we can do for each other is try not to tell each other to be any different, in any different place than we are. One thing that some people do is immerse themselves in the postmortems. And that can be helpful. And again, not going to tell you not to. People have been digesting them for me, which I find very helpful because I have not wanted to look at the news. That is not something I usually do. Just not look at the news and not listen to any analysis for a little while. So I appreciate that people are doing that, and I appreciate hearing some of the things they're saying because it's, of course, helpful. We try to learn from what has happened. But I will warn against one thing that can happen in this Monday morning quarterbacking that always follows an election. And that one thing is certainty. You see a whole lot of confirmation bias when, after any election, you know? People who have suspected, have worried for months, I don't know if this country will ever elect, or at least right now elect, a woman, black, South Asian woman, can now say, oh yeah, that was it. And maybe they're right. We don't actually know. People who have thought, you know, a lot of working class people just feel left behind. They feel fed up. They don't see things like college loan forgiveness as helping them at all, and they want to see something different going on. Well, you can look at this election and say, there you go. That attitude won the day. And maybe that's partially right too. There are so many reasons that people vote the way they do and that we have the outcomes that we do, but we don't really know what they were. We just tend to glom onto the ones that fit the way we already think. Because we hate uncertainty. People just really hate uncertainty. There are studies showing that there are more stress responses in the body of someone awaiting biopsy results that might reveal cancer than there are in the body of someone who has just been told that they do indeed have cancer. That's how much we hate not knowing. And so we reach for certainty. And there's a place for that too. You know, we have to proceed, at least provisionally, saying, okay, I think this is what's happening, and here I go. However, there are at least a couple ways that uncertainty is our friend in times like these. So one is the kind of thing that Zinn brings up. As a historian, as somebody who's studied the twists and turns of history, he wrote, again, this was in 2004, I think it's quite alive today, what leaps out from the history of the past 100 years is its utter unpredictability. A revolution to overthrow the Tsar of Russia in that most sluggish of semi-feudal empires not only startled the most advanced imperial powers, but took Lenin himself by surprise and sent him rushing by train to Petrograd. Who would have predicted the bizarre shifts of World War II, he says? The Nazi-Soviet pact? And then the German army, in violation of that pact not long after, rolling through Russia, apparently invincible, causing colossal casualties, being turned back at the gates of Leningrad on the western edge of Moscow in the streets of Stalingrad, followed by the defeat of the German army. And then, just a few years later, the utter defeat of Hitler and his whole Third Reich. He says, no one foresaw the disintegration of the old Western empires happening so quickly after the war, or the odd array of societies that would be created in the newly independent nations from the benign village socialism of Nyerere's Tanzania to the madness of Idi Amin's adjacent Uganda. Spain became an astonishment. I recall a veteran of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, those leftists who worked for a Republican Spain against Franco before World War II. He says, I recall a veteran of the brigade telling me that he could not imagine Spanish fascism being overthrown without another bloody war. But after Franco was gone, a parliamentary democracy came into being, open to socialists, communists, anarchists, everyone, and so on and so forth. I recommend the essay. So many examples. We can think of examples in our own time. I'm reading a book that you will hear more from in the weeks to come called How Minds Change by David McRaney, and he begins with the astonishing turnaround of views about same-sex marriage in this country. Astonishingly fast. Again, we can analyze in retrospect what made that happen. He's got some thoughts. But very few people predicted it beforehand. Those who did were being pretty quiet. So, I, like Zinn, take some hope from the utter unpredictability of our world. We have seen movements in our own time that we, for good and ill, movements we were thrilled to see, movements that made us want to tear our hair out, that we just did not predict. And sure, you can see the historical antecedents, but history being history, it could have gone another way. And speaking of things going another way, that's where we come in. The Unitarian minister of the 19th century, Theodore Parker, notably said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." Martin Luther King picked that up and quoted it. Parker and King may have had a greater faith in the universe having a moral arc than I do. I don't reckon it does. But I know this. If we want to make an arc bend, we put our weight on it. And we can bend it toward justice, toward kindness, toward love and compassion, toward gentleness and mercy. We'll be the ones who make the moral arc bend. And we've done it many times. In Parker's time, when he looked and wondered if we would see that long arc finally bring about abolition, and in King's time, seeing the next long-delayed chapter in the story of creeping, increasing justice for African Americans. It's uncertain. What will work? Will it be what worked before? We will try to learn from the past. And again, if what we do, if we say we did everything right, we did everything that worked in another movement, it didn't work here, what did we do wrong? What is wrong with these other people? What is going on? Let us just know. You do the best you can. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes something completely unexpected you didn't think was going to be on your side at all turns everything around, and suddenly the majority of U.S. Americans support something they were implacably against only 20 years before. Which brings me to the second way I hope we can take some hope from uncertainty. And that is that there's so much uncertainty in each human mind and spirit. Yeah, a lot. Way more than we know about ourselves. We tend to think that we're very certain. Right now, I'm thinking I'm an exception. I know what I'm doing. I have reasons for my beliefs, and I stick to them, and I'm consistent, but I know I'm fooling myself. The fact is that all the research shows people are not as set in their ways as we think. And you will be hearing a lot about that in the weeks to come through the lens of our benediction words from right here. What do those words have to tell us about our relationships with other people? What do they tell us about how to help our country strengthen its best tendencies and shun fascism? Well, plenty. But the temptation right now is to say, we know what kind of people are. We know what kind of country this is. Are you surprised? Some people say, well, this is America. It's always been like this. It's always been here. And the incoming president just brought it to the surface. Now we know. I mean, obviously, a majority of the people who got themselves out to vote voted for him. So that's not entirely wrong. Where it falls short as a theory of humanity is that everybody who goes to the polls and makes a decision is not the monolith we might think. None of us is consistent over time. All of us have ambivalence. One of the things that McRaney said was discovered by people who are trying to sway folks in favor of LGBT rights, specifically same-sex marriage in California, back in the year of Prop 8, they found that the people who declared themselves implacably opposed were actually of two minds. Say they really had no problem, they knew gay people and had no problem with them. Like, get married, I don't really care what you do. In some part of their minds. And in another part, a part very vulnerable to a particular ad campaign, they thought, oh, I want to control what my kid learns. And I don't like the idea of my kid going to school and learning a prince can marry a prince or she can marry a princess. What came out was flat. No. I'm against that. But what was inside was actually competing views. We're a lot more uncertain than we like to think. And that can be really scary, because what can be tapped in people with a few well-chosen words from a charismatic leader can be the hatred and the fear. But it can also be the compassion, the freedom, the sense of live your life, I'll live mine, let's leave each other alone. And sometimes a real passion for fighting for one another's freedoms. I find hope there too, and I hope you do too. We don't tend to see that uncertainty when we're arguing with each other. Brings out the most rigid in all of us. So I'm learning a lot from McRaney on how minds actually change. And I'll be sharing that with you along with other things over the weeks to come. I wish I could say something more cheerful than, I don't know. But it does help me to feel like, I don't know. We don't know what's going to happen next. But we do have a lot to say about it, a lot to do about it when we've got that energy. If you're still in a place that you want to curl up under the blankets, thanks for being here. Well done. And it's okay. Go get back under the blankets. There'll be work to do when you're ready. That's really all I want to say in conclusion. Be with your feelings. Allow others to be with theirs. Turn toward community and connection. They really make a difference. And keep coming back, because we here, we are the ones we have been waiting for. And this is the place that can guide us through the hard night. Blessings all.